Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
At the same time, reducing policy restraint too late or too little could unduly weaken economic activity and employment.
Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell.
In considering any adjustments to the target range for the policy rate, we will carefully assess the incoming data, the evolving outlook, and the balance of risks. The committee does not expect that it will be appropriate to reduce the target range until it has gained greater confidence that inflation is moving sustainably toward 2%. We remain committed to bringing inflation back down to our 2% goal and to keeping longer-run inflation expectations well anchored. Restoring price stability is essential to set the stage for achieving maximum employment and stable prices over the longer run. To conclude, we understand that our actions affect communities, families, and businesses across the country. Everything we do is in service to our public mission.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Federal Reserve remains squarely focused on our dual mandate to promote maximum employment and stable prices for the American people.
Testifying before a House committee earlier in the week, Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell.
The economy has made considerable progress toward these objectives over the past year. While inflation remains above the FOMC's objective of 2%, it has eased substantially, and the slowing in inflation has occurred without a significant increase in unemployment. As labor market tightness has eased and progress on inflation has continued, the risks to achieving our employment and inflation goals have been moving into better balance. Even so, the committee remains highly attentive to inflation risks and is acutely aware that high inflation imposes significant hardship, especially on those least able to meet the higher costs of essentials like food, housing, and transportation. The FOMC is strongly committed to returning inflation to its 2% objective. Restoring price stability is essential to achieve a sustained period of strong labor market conditions that benefit all. Economic activity expanded at a strong pace over the past year. For 2023 as a whole, gross domestic product increased 3.1%, bolstered by solid consumer demand and improving supply conditions. Activity in the housing sector was subdued over the past year, largely reflecting high mortgage rates. High interest rates also appear to have been weighing on business fixed investment. The labor market remains relatively tight, but supply and demand conditions have continued to come into better balance. Since the middle of last year, payroll job gains have averaged 239,000 jobs per month, and the unemployment rate has remained near historical lows at 3.7%. Strong job creation has been accompanied by an increase in the supply of workers, particularly among individuals aged 25 to 54, and a continued strong pace of immigration. Job vacancies have declined, and nominal wage growth has been easing. Although the jobs-to-workers gap has narrowed, labor demand still exceeds the supply of available workers. The strong labor market over the past 2 years has also helped to narrow long-standing disparities in employment and earnings across demographic groups. Inflation has eased notably over the past year, but remains above the FOMC's longer-run goal of 2%. Total personal consumption expenditures prices rose 2.4% over the 12 months ending in January. Excluding the volatile food and energy categories, core PCE prices rose 2.8%, a notable slowing from 2022 that was widespread across both goods and services prices. Long-term inflation expectations appear to have remained well-anchored, as reflected by a broad range of surveys of households, businesses, and forecasters, as well as measures from financial markets. After significantly tightening the stance of monetary policy since early 2022, the FOMC has maintained the target range for the federal funds rate at 5.25% to 5.5% since its meeting last July. We've also continued to shrink our balance sheet at a brisk pace and in a predictable manner. A restrictive stance of monetary policy is putting downward pressure on economic activity and inflation. We believe that our policy rate is likely at its peak for this tightening cycle. If the economy evolves broadly as expected, it will likely be appropriate to begin dialing back policy restraint at some point this year. But the economic outlook is uncertain, and ongoing progress toward our 2% objective for inflation is not assured. Reducing policy restraint too soon or too much could result in a reversal of progress we've seen in inflation and ultimately require even tighter policy to get inflation back to 2%.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
AEM is the Association of Equipment Manufacturers. We represent over 1,000 non-road equipment manufacturers. So that includes the five sectors of construction, forestry, mining, utility, and of course, agriculture.
Kurt Blades with AEM.
So it's all of those brands that you'd be familiar with. We represent on a global stage some of the brands like, you know, John Deere, Case, Caterpillar, New Holland, Kubota, and go down the list from the large brands to the small brands, technology companies like Topcon and Trimble, but also the component folks that are making the things that make the machines themselves.
On areas of strengths and weaknesses.
It's a mixed bag. Ag tractors, so those over 100 horsepower are four-wheel drives and combines, actually saw some growth in 2023. Smaller tractors, those under 40 horsepower, 40 to 100 horsepower, those were all declined. In fact, under 40 horsepower was down just a little over 10% year over year. Again, keep in mind, those are coming off of some really solid years in 2020 and 2021 and 2022. A little bit of a hangover there, if you will, on those small tractors. But I'll tell you, I get really optimistic when I see a 30% growth in articulated four-wheel drive tractors in 2023 over 2022. You know, that farmers are all optimistic long-term view of agriculture, because you don't buy articulated four-wheel drive tractor for next year. You buy it for the next 5 to 10 years. So you have to feel good about the long-term viability of farming operation to make those kinds of investments.
So when it comes to the future, is he optimistic?
You don't get involved in agriculture if you're not just a little bit optimistic, because we know long-term, farmers got to grow the food. It's going to be a market for U.S. agriculture products. I did see a report that came out this morning, just this morning, that, you know, corn and soybean volumes were high as we wrap up the 2023 crop. But the demand, the global demand, continues to be strong. We've seen some softness in the commodity prices, and obviously there are weather concerns and there's global markets and there's all the other concerns that we have to worry about with agriculture. But I always look forward with optimism. Whether 2024 is predicted to be a flat year or maybe even down just a little bit, long term, it continues to be a strong bet. And that being the case, the capital equipment purchases for that 5-year, 10-year window. So I remain optimistic that it's going to continue to be a year for the equipment market moving forward.
And it seems like just a few years ago, we experienced issues with infrastructure. Has that subsided?
We operate in the global environment. And, whether you're buying a tractor or a refrigerator or a pinball machine, parts are coming from different countries. It seems like we've kind of turned the corner finally on those challenges that we were dealing with the supply chain disruptions. And, you know, they take a while to work themselves through the system. So it's easier for farmer to take delivery on the machines that they been in previous, you know, months, have some of that pent up demand that's sort of working itself out. So now you're beginning to see time shorten just a little bit. You're beginning to see a little bit of equipment showing up on dealers' lots. That's a return to normalcy. That also learned some things during the pandemic is planning ahead for your equipment purchases. I always encourage farmers to work closely with their dealer and manufacturer that they're meeting their equipment needs for this year and for the next few years. If they can get that equipment when they want it, take advantage of that technology right in time for harvest, right in time for planting.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
A report we did about a year ago from Congresswoman Letlow in Louisiana, she requested we do a study looking at fertilizer costs. We did that one.
Dr. Bart Fisher is co-director of the Ag and Food Policy Center at Texas A&M, a former chief economist for the House Ag Committee.
And then Senator Bozeman followed with a request asking if we would just look across the board. And so for those of you who aren't familiar with our center, and some of you may actually be involved in the process, but we have 94 what we call representative farms in 30 states around the country, and our team is constantly on the road updating them. And in every location, we work with a panel of 4 to 6 growers who create a farm on paper that's representative of their area, and we bring it back, and we have these huge models on campus where we can simulate forecasts of financial performance on those farms. And all the same, too, is if Congress wants to change something, you know, if they want to change the reference price, we can simulate the impact that would have. You know, we did a report last year when there all this hullabaloo was going on about, you know, eliminating stepped-up basis. We did a big report looking at what that would do to farms and handed it off to Congress, showing the explosion that would occur in primarily in capital gains, but also in estate tax liability. So it's a very useful tool. We ran it on those farms on the right, and we actually went back to the growers and said, hey, tell us exactly what y'all are doing and spending, not what fertilizer prices are in your area. What are you going to spend per acre? And across the board, those were the estimates. You know, in north of 130%, fuel and lube, you know, north of 80. This was a lot of this report. This report was done right after, you know, Russia announced their invasion of Ukraine. And so this captured that dynamic in fuel as well. And so, anyway, we passed that off to Congress. But I put it in the background, too, because I do think this is going to factor into where Congress is going on the farm safety net, because they are concerned that it's not reflective of cost.
And talks about the Inflation Reduction Act and its ties to conservation.
The Inflation Reduction Act of 2022, the so-called another show of hands, anybody in the room think that spending $1.7 trillion is going to reduce inflation? Any takers? I didn't think so. It's Washington has a way of coming up with creative names for legislation, but the so-called Inflation Reduction Act was really a compromise in response to the Bipartisan Budget Act that the president had proposed, and it was a multi-trillion dollar bill. And so Senator Manchin, Senator Sinema from Arizona more or less held that up. They ended up reaching a compromise this past fall called the Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA of 2022. Some of you don't see it in here. One of those provisions sandwiched in here is debt relief for socially disadvantaged growers. They had floated that earlier in the year. It got held up in the courts. Congress came back. They more or less used the money that was over here in this gray part and just repurposed it here so it doesn't show up again. But some of you may very well have already received notice in the mail that all of your FSA-held debt is being completely wiped out. And so that was a component of this. The more notable in terms of size was the one on conservation. And so it included almost $17 billion in plus up to conservation spending. You know, there's a lot of things where I'll poke at the administration, and admittedly I worked for Republicans for 8.5 years on the Hill. Now I'm in a nonpartisan, you know, bipartisan, all of the above sort of role. But one thing I will say about the current administration and Congress that was controlled by Democrats is that with all the focus on climate, the approach they took was to plus up the existing programs. And so it could have been a lot worse, right? You know, cap and trade and all these other things that had been considered a decade earlier. And so I may poke some fun, but I'll give them some credit there that they stuck with, you know, the programs that we know. The one problem with that, though, is instead of just increasing and leaving it at that, of course, we had to tie all sorts of new strings to it. And it's a one-time infusion.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
And so my question to you, Chairman Powell, is there anything you can do specifically to deal with food costs?
During a semi-annual monetary policy report to Congress, Jerome Powell, chairman of the Federal Reserve, in front of the Senate Banking Committee, and Montana Senator John Tester.
So as you, I'm telling a farmer his business, but if you look at the food cost to the consumer, part of that is commodity costs, and that was partly spiked because of Ukraine, grains and oil and that kind of thing. But the rest of it is a lot of costs in the supply chain from when it leaves the farm to get, you know, collected and processed and trucked around and then put on the shelves and then the stores, you know, and all of those costs are just part of the general economy. So as the labor market cools off from its overheated status 2 years ago, you will see, and you have seen, you know, food inflation flattening out. And so, you know, the really high rates of inflation have come down. Yeah. The prices, of course, have not.
Correct. I would just say that cattle's doing better. Grain actually has dropped in price at the farm gate, and I don't want to get into that debate with you at all because we probably agree, but it'd take too long, take too much time. We got other stuff to talk about.
I'd be learning from you.
You've discussed in previous hearings the impacts that the pandemic shutdowns and supply chain issues have had on economies globally. How does the U.S. economy look today compared to our competitor nations, particularly China?
Well, I start with the advanced economies. You know, we're doing the best of anybody. We've got the strongest growth and the lowest inflation of the advanced economies. China is a whole different story. China is having, you know, significant difficulties with its economy right now, and they're in a very different place than we are.
And so to repeat that, what I heard you say is that the economy of the United States is basically in better shape than any other economy in the world?
Any other major economy, yes.
Yes, okay. Look, one of the other challenges out there is housing in communities all across this country, whether you're in Montana or whether you're in a city in Ohio. Workforce housing in particular is a top priority, top commodity, so to speak. Plenty of folks, great organizations are working to address this. I meet them every day, and I appreciate the work they're doing. But how do these housing supplies issues show up in the data that the FOMC uses to make decisions?
So housing prices don't go into the data. Housing starts and renovations and things like that are just business activity, and that shows up. But when it comes to inflation, we convert ownership into an imputed rent, and then we look at rents.
Okay.
And so we look at, that's how we look at all that. So we're not directly affected by changes in housing prices, but over time those will drive rents up. So
is it fair to ask, are there economic trends that you see for housing?
Yes. So I there's two big things going on. One is we have this underlying shortage of housing, and it's due to things like, you know, difficulties of zoning. A lot of the close in to cities, places that were already built, and so more difficult to get zoning, more difficult to get people and materials and all that. That's one thing, and that's not going away. Then there's just a ton of things happening because of the pandemic, because of inflation, because of higher rates. And those are, in the short term, those have really, they're weighing on the housing market. But as rates come down and that all goes through the economy, we're still going to be back to a place where we don't have enough housing.
Well, once again, thank you, Chairman Powell, for your work. I very much appreciate it.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We all know that much of our fuel goes into on-highway, heavy-duty truck transportation primarily. But we've done a lot of work to build out what we call premium markets, where pressures to decarbonize are significant and growing, and alternatives to petroleum are few.
Kurt Kavarik is with the Clean Fuels Alliance America.
Marine is one that we'll touch on. Other areas that we've done a lot of work, obviously, are in home heating oil in the Northeast, railroads, as well as aviation. But marine has a specific hurdle to its adoption. That is, the renewable fuel standard that was created by Congress 20 years ago explicitly excluded the fuel blended and sold into the marine market from being eligible for participation in the program. So if a biodiesel producer wants to sell to a cruise line, the credit that is associated with that gallon that they're given to comply with the renewable fuel standard does not apply. So we've got legislation that we've helped move along here in Congress. We've got a Republican from Iowa, Marionette Miller Meeks, a Democrat from the San Francisco area, Mr. Garamendi, have introduced the bill back in December. And one thing that's kind of unconventional about this bill is that it's got geographic and bipartisan support. So we've got champions from California, Florida, and the Midwest, and we're seeking more. And what this bill would do is essentially remove that bit of red tape, so that the financial incentive or the incentive to comply with the renewable fuel standard can stay attached to that gallon, even if it's blended in the marine sector. And I mentioned at the beginning, you know, we're focusing on markets where the pressure to decarbonize is real, but the alternatives to decarbonization and petroleum are few. So think of some of the largest ocean-going vessels. They're not going to electrify anytime soon. They're not going to find other ways to decarbonize. Our fuel, which is 75% less carbon emitting on average, can essentially be used, drop in to the fuel tank in these ocean-going vessels and immediately displace carbon.
How can biofuels assist the shipping industry today?
You know, you talk about the lifespan of a piece of equipment. You know, heavy-duty trucking might be 10 or 15 or 20 years. Think of the lifespan of a cargo vessel or a cruise ship, and the mechanics in that vessel. These probably have a lifespan of 30, 40, 50 years. You know, you're not going to turn over that fleet, even if you found another technology that was less carbon emitting, whether it was fuel cells or hydrogen or something else. The fact is that the ability to drop in the fuel today, next week, and have those carbon reduction emissions immediate is the real appeal to this fuel. And think about, you know, in Houston, the shipping area that you have there. We've got biodiesel producers along the Gulf Coast where this would be a great opportunity for them in their backyard to feed into this new market and deliver those carbon benefits, the economic benefits, the environmental benefits. So we're hopeful. You know, we're not naive about this. And, you know, when you have a Congress that has difficulty doing the basic functions of a Congress, keeping the government open and the lights on, for example, you know, we're not going into this too naive in terms of how quickly we get it done. This is a good starting point with this bill. We hope to have a Senate companion introduced here in the next couple of weeks. And then we're going to use the opportunity of our conference and other meetings that we're having here in Washington to try to line up additional support, get additional co-sponsors on that that bill, and hopefully we can get it across the finish line here not too long.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
You know, what's the point of doing it if we don't see improvements? Let's say we do get new funding, then where do we go with that 222-vote margin? I think one of them is there's still a question of could we just do it bipartisan? I mean, it's where it's going to end up. It's very similar to the last two farm bills. The one that ultimately went across to the president's desk was a bipartisan bill.
Dr. Bart Fisher is co-director of the Ag and Food Policy Center at Texas A&M.
What about margin, incorporating cost of production? You know, we hear a lot about, well, is it going to go in Title I? Could that replace ARC and PLC? I don't think that's going to happen. In part because if you already have a crop insurance product, Congress is sort of loath to do something administered by FSA if there's already a product out there where you could put skin in the game. I'm not going to ask, if any of you raised your hand and said you've purchased margin coverage, it's because you've got farms in other areas of the country. It's not available here, right? It's a limited offering on specific crops. It really started with rice. Corn came in. But it's very limited. It's a county-based margin. It has not been terribly popular. So one big question mark you could follow is, could there be some significant improvements to the RMA-administered margin protection policy? I think that that's also a possibility, but I don't see that porting over into Title I. I think the path, not necessarily the path of least resistance, the smart path there is simply, you know, make your reference prices more reflective of cost of production. You get to the same end without having to completely recreate the mousetrap.
And for one group of producers, there's an interesting twist with the program known as Stacks.
It is something we are working on internally, but are having conversations with the Hill on. So I'm not going to put words in their mouth on what they may or may not be considering, but it's certainly something that we're working on and we're having conversations with them about. To me, I mean, the point I'm going to be making is I think that's eminently reasonable. You know, at the time, if you think through the progression, if you look at 14, it was Lent was completely out as a covered commodity. Stacks was all that was left. When we get to the Bipartisan Budget Act of 18, well, cotton is back in. We had tried cottonseed. That didn't work. And so I'm sitting in the office thinking, well, let's just put them both together. Seed cotton's now going to be the covered commodity. And we came up with a price series to do it and set the reference price. And so you have all of that at play. But at that point in time, the other side of, you know, folks who are advocating on the other side of the table said, well, you know, now that cotton is a covered commodity, you know, Stacks was offered in lieu of being a covered commodity. Now that it is a covered commodity, Stacks has to go away. That's what we were told. And so we fought that for several weeks. And one of the main arguments we made was the base acre argument, right, that not everybody has it. And then the compromise was, okay, we'll bring it back, but you cannot have both, right? And it's the only one. With SCO, I mean, and you can go buy SCO now and have PLC. And so part of our thinking is that if we do come up with a streamlined policy, some may be, I mean, there's a lot of money in Stacks for budget. And so some cotton growers may say, well, I don't want to give up. I mean, we already have a decent product. Let's not, you know, mess with it. It's all downside. Well, where could there be some upside? There could be some upside in a compromise that says, okay, well, just like SCO, you can have anyone who gets this new area-wide coverage can also have PLC, where there's no choice to be made. And so it's not that Congress is advocating or that they're considering it now, but it's absolutely something, you know, we're going to be visiting with them about. And I know at least on the House side, you know, their commodity staff are also from West Texas who understand these issues incredibly well. And it's something so if y'all know Trevor White from down at New Home, it's something he's talked about a lot as well. It's just the need to tighten up on the top end, all these area coverages. And it's only gotten more complicated with the advent of ECO. And so to me, I think there's a very real possibility there. I think it can make for a very robust safety net if done right.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
At a White House meeting of President Biden's Competition Council, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack reported that his department's taking dozens of steps to enhance livestock market integrity and protect producers from unfair practices, to which the president asked,
"What kind of a response you're getting from farmers?"
And Vilsack's answer,
"Mr. President, they welcome these changes. For far too long, they felt that they were at the mercy of a relatively small number of integrators and processors. To the extent that they know that they have a balanced playing field, that they understand better who they're doing business with, they understand that they have certain rights, that they can, in fact, seek a better deal. All of that, I think, is something that's been very much desired.
Desired, according to Vilsack, by all producers and all major producer groups. Gary Crawford, Washington.